You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woohooer, a hand clapper, a high fiver? I kind of like the high five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At chumbacasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses. So don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at chumbacasino.com. No purchase necessary. VGW. Void or prohibited by law. See terms and conditions 18 plus. Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to this very special episode of My First Show, celebrating the Tony season that was, question mark, wasn't, is. We are here today with two extraordinary artists who made an extraordinary play last season that I was lucky enough to be at the opening night of and became a big fan of, mostly because I couldn't explain it when I would tell people about it. I couldn't properly find the words for the excruciatingly hilarious, painful, serious, of the moment topic that it covered and made me think and feel and change. And that's Slave Play. That's the play. The play that we don't have words to describe. So we're going to spend an hour and find those words to describe because it is a really special moment in our theatrical history. And thank you for being here today to talk about Slave Play, Robert O'Hara and Atu Blankson-Wood. Hi, guys.
Thank you. Hi there.
Hi. Hi, Eva.
Well, it's very interesting to think about your play having the moment it had in 2019. I think about how the world has obviously changed and changed so much in 2020 and 2021. So I'd love to start off, as I do every episode, asking how you each are, how you're doing. And if you could talk about how you relive and rethink about your play and your experience with that play in these times, I know the audience would love to know more. Robert, let's start with you.
I'm doing very well. I am lucky enough to have another home upstate that I can go to and that I've been at for some time throughout the pandemic. And, you know, you're right that Slave Play continues to live on in various ways. We have a running thread among me and Jeremy and the cast, and we're always checking in and making sure everyone is well and safe. But it's difficult to talk about plays and difficult to think about plays in this time, and I'm conflicted in the celebration of it all, and also I'm overjoyed in the celebration of it all. So I want to hold both spaces for the play,
which is kind of fitting because the play is about holding spaces for conflicting ideas and yes, different feelings, and so that works, that tracks, Robert. I get that. How about you, Atu?
I'm doing well. It has been, I moved to Los Angeles March 8th of last year. Mm. So it has been a very strange transition to a new place. And also this longing I've been having for, you know, New York and the theater and all of that, like Robert is saying, you know, it's difficult to talk about because it feels like a long distant friend or something that you haven't been able to contact in some time. And so there's this longing as well. But I feel really blessed to be out here. I'm near family. I've just been taking this time to sort of get really still and think about, you know, what's important to me, not only in my life, but also in the, also artistically. With regard to slave play, it's really kind of amazing how prescient the play is and how, how it's continued to sort of unfold in my life. Not only the topics of race that are discussed, but specifically to my character, you know, the idea of how one values themselves and how they believe they are valued in the world. Not having this artistic outlet that has sort of pinned much of my identity to, has really forced me to also look at how I value myself and how I feel I'm valued in the world. So that has sort of been a running theme for me this mm-hmm. year.
Yeah. And can we talk about the year a bit?
Yeah.
What have you been doing? How has it affected you? How has it changed you? How has it made you look at the American theater and your history in it and your future in it?
Yeah, I mean, I have been, the film and TV industry is really trying to putter along here. So like, they're really trying to do things. So like, I have been auditioning quite a bit. And that's kind of keeping me artistically alive. But also, I've been looking to my own projects and looking at how I can be a generative artist, which I don't think I would have thought about had we not had this shutdown. I think something that's been confirmed for me is that I'm a theater creature. Like that was my first love. That's how I came to performing, and it's in me. It's really, really in me. I'm not sure what the future of it looks like, but I do know that my love for it is deep and hopefully when it does come back, I would like to engage with it in a different way. You know, I'd like to engage with it as a generative artist, as someone who is not just waiting for a job to show up, but also is involved in shaping, my career and the theater itself.
It's interesting to think that being Black and being queer and making work about that topic, those topics, yeah, was viewed probably 2 years ago, 3 years ago, Robert, when you guys started staging, developing, and when you first directed Slave Play at New York Theater Workshop, was scary for artistic directors and producers and audience members. Now it feels like the Black queer experience and story is necessary to be heard and told. Is people are fighting to hold space to tell those stories and to make sure those stories are seen and heard. What do you think about that? What's your take on that idea?
Well, you know, I've always lived in that space. Yeah. I've always been Black and queer. So
yeah.
Yes.
It's not new for me. I think what we're really talking about is white folks.
Correct.
And people in power.
That's right.
And so I think that it's like being in a room all your life around a bunch of people, and then all of a sudden they turn and they say, oh, wait a second, you're here? You're still here? So I find it to be quite fabulous. But, you know, no one gets a hero cookie because, you know, we've been here and we've been telling these stories, and I've had to find Black queer stories outside of the mainstream of theaters in order to keep myself going as an artist. But also, that is not the totality of my experience in life. So, you know, there is that sort of, you know, celebration of it, but also as a yes and, as they say, in the play itself. Yeah.
Absolutely. I'm excited to talk to you guys about this next topic. One of the many firsts that Slave Play brought to Broadway was the blackout. For the first time in history, all 804 seats of Broadway's Golden Theater were occupied by Black identifying audience members in communion, celebration, and recognition of Broadway's rich, diverse, and fraught history of Black work. Attu, what was it like to perform that night?
It was deeply affirming. You know, I feel like much of what the play discusses is how you feel a little gaslit when it comes to your experience as a Black person, as a queer person. Yes, this experience that Robert's talking about being in a room and people turning and being like, oh, there you are. There was something really affirming, and I felt really seen for the first time in a way that I hadn't felt on stage. What I realized was that it's important to have these affirmations as well. I had just come off of a show where, you know, I've been doing, yes, theater that is Black and queer for quite some time. But the experience of doing it for an audience that understands that experience, it was just deeply affirming.
Yeah, you know, I remember being in the audience, and I went to my seat, and immediately I said, "We're not starting on time. We're not even starting anywhere near on time," because there was a communion happening. Mm-hmm. People were, it was like, you know, church really. And people were literally in the aisles talking to people who they hadn't seen, and people who they've worked with. So there was almost a revival feeling of it, you know, an anticipation. Yeah. Because of course, everyone was not there because they were excited to see the play. And there was a lot of, justified criticism of what was this thing called slave play on Broadway. Mm-hmm. So there was a huge sense, I think, of skepticism, but there was grace in the room too, which I found to be really wonderful. And it's something to be in a room where people are actually following the journey of the BIPOC and Black characters, and not just simply watching it, but that can actually, that are living it with them in a different way than if you have a predominantly, you know, white audience. So those characters began to pop for the audience in a different way. It's just, you know, it's you know, being in a community that sees you and that recognizes your journey as their own. Is quite thrilling. So that was fun for the Blackout.
And this revival, that's like the perfect word, Robert, because also just like being on the stage and having people respond, it really did feel like church, right? People just shouting out and it felt like amens and hallelujahs. Yes.
They stopped the show several times.
Several times, you know, and there was, you know, and like you were saying, this feeling that like we wouldn't start on time. There was also like, I was like, this play is going to be the longest it has ever been.
Right. The stage manager report is like 3 hours. Right.
Exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
And it probably was, because then I think there was a talk back afterwards, and then,
yeah,
you know, they filled the street. Like, and would not leave.
Yes.
Like,
yes.
Just out in the street talking, you know, so we had sort of taken over not only Broadway theater, but the Broadway street, you know, in front
Amen.
Of
them.
So it was quite fascinating and fun.
That's amazing. Yeah. And what I'm envisioning, what might have also felt so, I mean, a million different feelings for the actors on stage, but that final scene when the giant, or when the mirrored wall and Clint's set reflects what is being reflected back as an entire Black audience versus probably many of those nights too. It was a largely white audience. What was that like?
It was like having your entire, I'm getting emotional. That's weird. It was like having your entire family there, your entire lineage there. It was like hearing the words yes over and over and over again, you know, even through the pain of the play. It was like hearing, yes, show us this pain. We understand this pain. You have freedom to show us this pain. It was a big yes, which felt incredible.
And that you deserve to be here. This is your space. take yes. the space. You own the space, you know? Not that we were sort of like, you know, somehow sneaking in the space in the back door and hoping that no one notices up, but no, to take all the space on Broadway yeah. that we wanted yeah. and needed. It was that type of grace in the audience, I feel.
Yes.
What's your hope for Broadway's future, Robert?
Well, I hope that they come back with more interesting and exciting and diverse and stories. And I hope that they don't sort of like, you know, fall into the trap of being afraid you know, the focus, because of course Broadway is a commercial venture, you know?
Yeah.
So we knew from the start, A, that we were going to be closing at a certain time, and that we were going to be making no money, you know, from the beginning of Slave Play, because mm-hmm. It was about offering the opportunity. You know, the tickets were lowered, the capacity, free things were handed out, you know, blackout nights. So we actually didn't have that struggle with the commercial sphere of mm-hmm. trying to, you know, make sure we get as much money as possible this week, you know. So I hope that there are more journeys like that. That can populate a Broadway because, you know, there will always be Phantoms and Les Mis and all of that. But there also needs to be other avenues of engagement, because we use Broadway as an example of theater. We tell the world that the best play and the best musical of the year happened to be on these few blocks of Broadway, mm-hmm. which is of course inherently a lie. But if we're going to say that this is where the best theater is, then we should actually have the best theater there.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Oof. Yes to that. I agree with that. Well, let's dial back to everyone's humble beginnings of early theater and the love for theater and what was maybe at one point seemingly the best theater. And that's the first show that you ever saw. Atu, let's start with you.
It would be my oldest sister's high school production of Bye Bye Birdie. because I just remember sitting in the audience, and I must have been maybe five or six years old. And just thinking people can do that with their time and energy. And there was like some like click of like, that's what I'm supposed to be doing. Mm. I just knew it. And yeah, all these years later, I remember just sitting there and feeling that, you know, all of this energy that I had, you know, I was a pretty shy kid, but in the home when I was comfortable, I loved to make noise. And like, I was quoted as a kid as saying like, I love making noise. Like that was my go-to phrase. And to understand that I could channel that and put that somewhere, like that was the first time I realized that. And I'll never forget, my sister was in a full head to toe red leotard.
Was she Kim? Who was she?
I don't remember. I have no idea. I just remember being like, she looks amazing and she's under these lights and I want to do that. It was Springbrook High School's production of Bye Bye Birdie.
Bye Bye Birdie has inspired more theatrical careers than it deserves is my thought. True.
Agreed.
I can point to one as well. Robert, how about you?
Well, you know, my grandmother used to call me the ringleader because I would always get the grandkids, you know, dancing and singing and playing around and in the backyard or whatever, because I was one of the older grandkids. And so I never really thought of that as something that, you know, should be aspired to. You know, you shouldn't aspire to be the ringleader. It was always a reprimand. Like, he's the ringleader of all of it. Richer than the West, like, the ringleader is over there. Get up. And, you know, but so I was always writing and always, like, creating stuff. But I guess one of the things that is sort of, like, my first really experience that meant something to me was one that I was directly involved in, that I had I had decided in the sixth grade to write an adaptation of Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. And I named it Ebony and the Seven Cool Cats. Because there was literally one white person in my entire class of, I think, 500, sixth graders. And if that. So I wrote it, and I remember one day going to my teacher, because there was always the sixth grade production of something, you know. And I said to one of my home teacher, I said, well, I wrote this play, and I don't know if it's interesting, but I think maybe we could do this. And she read it, and she was like, yes, we can do this. I just remember that experience. And because I don't remember being in it, I remember working on it. And at one point, I remember telling the person playing the evil witch when they sing Diana Ross's Mirror Mirror on the wall. and at another time, Ebony sang I'm Coming Out. And I was just like, there's something really amazing about this. But then I would look in the audience and all the parents would be like, there's something really off about this. So that was my first experience and going, oh, I see I can affect the audience just by what they say on the stage, which is profound, right? Because usually kids are on stage, and if you're a kid, everyone's like, you know, looking at their kid and like, you know, smiling and snapping pictures or whatever. But that you could sort of galvanize a room based on a musical choice or a costume piece. So that was sort of my sixth grade class with Ebony and the Seven Cool Cats that I didn't have permission to adapt at all.
No rights were granted in that production, but all were you.
Robert, yes. Robert, I need a copy of this script ASAP. You know what I mean?
But what's kind of amazing is that production, Robert, has a connective thread to slave play. I mean, you use pop music in all sorts of shocking and exemplifying ways. You rattled your audience to tell a story that they weren't expecting and to subvert. I mean, have you thought about in the past that there is a thread from that early experience to your latest one?
I think there's a thread just because of who I am and how I see the world and how I walk through the world as a queer Black man. That, you know, there are things that, you know, I think queer kids, you know, latch on to in order to get through whatever they have to get through. And many of those things are people who are, you know, a little odd, like themselves. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And things mm-hmm. that sort of like, you know, I was obsessed with Michael Jackson when other people were saying he's odd, you know. So I think, you know, being othered as a kid, even without knowing who you are, but other people othering you, attaches you to people who have been othered in the world.
Yeah. And Robert, I have this like image of you as a sixth grader saying what you said on our stage that I think that first preview one, which was, if you have come here expecting comfort, you may not have it. I will not give it to you. Like, I just imagine you saying that as a sixth grader to that audience, which was about to be, they were about to be, like you said, unsettled by watching this play.
And I had, of course, no idea. I just knew I wasn't going to have a bunch of, you know, white kids doing Snow White. I mean, Black kids doing Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs. I mean, we had nothing but Black kids. So obviously it had to be a Black adaptation. I didn't know I was doing something, you know, outrageous to make Snow White into a Black woman named Ebony. You know, but in retrospect, it was slightly outrageous to turn the dwarfs into the Seven Cool Cats, you know, and give them a particular type of language in life.
Wow, at age 11, you knew who you were. That's impressive. Even if you didn't know, you knew.
Right.
That's amazing. So first shows you were in, Atu, was that a amateur? Was that a professional show? What was the
it
first
was, show? It was the second grade play at Cannon Road Elementary School. It was Johnny Appleseed.
Oh, God.
And I played Johnny Appleseed. I split the role with my best friend at the time, Nathan Young. But and it's interesting, Robert, there's some parallel here in that, you know, Johnny Appleseed is this like very American, Americana like legend, right? And you had two young Black boys playing these roles, you know. And I also went back to think about it, and I was like, at the time Johnny Appleseed happened, these two boys would have been slaves, you know?
Right.
So in retrospect, I'm like, wow, I don't think I would, as an 8-year-old, like I was aware of the audience's response, but I'm sure that was picked up by some adults, you know, at least in the audience. And now in retrospect, I'm like, that's really amazing to me that happened.
And do you think it was a deliberate thing, or were there white people in your class?
Oh yes, there were a lot of white people in our class. But Nathan Young and I were the best singers in the class. So like, you know, I don't think it was like, yeah, I don't know that it was necessarily like a very pointed and like racial choice, but uh-huh. I know that we were the best ones.
That's actually quite an interesting thread as well from your start to slave play too, if you think
yeah.
about it.
Yeah.
That's interesting. What about you, Robert? Was Ebony and the Seven Cool Cats your first, or really?
No, I was an old hat by then. I was doing all the shows by then. No. I just wasn't writing them. I guess my first memory of being on the stage was in the first or the second grade, just like Atu. But in Hansel and Gretel. And I was neither Hansel nor Gretel. Instead, I was supposed to wear something brown so I could be a tree stump. Oh. And so I was a tree stump. And I remember Gretel having to sit on me. Now, I may be making it up, but I remember Gretel having to sit on me. And I was like, oh, no, we can't be doing this. I won't be
doing this. Gag.
And it was a realization. Wait a second. I have no lines. And she's going to sit on me? No. But it's like when you have like 900 kids and everybody has to have a part. Like there were trees, there were rocks. And you had to like wear green if you're going to be the top of a tree. Like, you know. So I just remember having to wear brown or dark colors and be a tree stump. And I knew, so instead of like going, oh my God, this is what I want to do. I was like, oh no, I won't be doing this part anymore.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on Essie Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
Robert, were you one of very few Black kids?
Only? No. I think that there was a hefty mix, I guess, because mm-hmm. if I'm talking about the first grade, yeah, because then I went to Catholic school in the third grade, and then I went to a predominantly Black school in the fourth and fifth and sixth grades. But at that point, it was a pretty mixed group of people in the first grade, but it was like everyone had to have a part. Hansel and Gretel, how many characters are there, Hansel? I mean, there's three, like the Hansel
three
and Gretel,
I can think of,
and, yeah. and a witch. So, and they're walking through a forest. So, you know, half the school has to be a force, you know. Right. So it's not like, and I just was like a little bit my ego, because I guess I thought I was the prize and that no one should be sitting. Where if you look around, 900 other students are rocks and tree stumps too. You know, I'm the only tree stump going, wait a second, you guys sit on me.
Right. Well, your directorial vision in place was beginning to show, and that's a good thing. What about first professional shows? Robert, why don't we start with you? The first one you got paid to, and whether this is directing or acting in, but paid be it through dinner, through money, through whatever it is, but it was a professional gig.
Oh, well, I was never an actor professionally. That was out of my system very early. Right out of graduate school. I mean, right out of college, really. It was like, oh, no.
Bless you.
I'm going to go that direction. So my first professional gig, well, really, it would be the internship in graduate school, because we were getting paid to assist. Because I went to Columbia as a director.
Who was that? What production was that?
It was Tazewell Thompson doing, I think, Holiday Heart or something. I think it was Cheryl L. West's play at Manhattan Theater Club. All I remember is I was there on the first day. On the second day of rehearsal, Tazewell says, everyone is out. We're not having anybody else in the rehearsal until tech. And so that was literally, because apparently there were some issues with the actors or whatever, and sort of who was in the room with them or whatever. But so I was like, oh, but does that include me? Because I'm your assistant. He's like, yes, you. And so it's like my first professional gig was not being in the room in the entire rehearsal process. And after that, I guess I really started at the Public Theater in my internship in George Wolf's office. So that was my first gig. And he also had me assist Danny Sullivan and Adrian Hall for two productions in Shakespeare in the Park. So I guess that was really the first time that I was sort of on a major project, not necessarily as a writer or a director, but mainly as assistant.
And assisting for George, I mean, was that just one of the dreams coming true to, you know, be a young Black guy who's looking to be a director and here's this unbelievable talent? And
oh, absolutely. I mean, I eventually did assist him on Blade to the Heat and Bring in the Noise, Bring in the Funk. But I had, you know, one of those seminal experiences in the American theater was watching Jelly's Last Jam on Broadway. And it just blew me through the back of the theater. And also in college, I had experienced his play, The Color Museum, and was in a production of it in the plays in college. And so being able to be in his presence, and not only being in his presence, but to be mentored by him right out of school, was really tremendous. And in all ways, you know, because, you know, it wasn't easy. George is a taskmaster. So it wasn't like, you know, come here, little grasshopper, and sit on my lap and I'll tell you all the things about the world that you should know. No, it was, you know, very in your face and very, this is what the world is going to give to you. So you better be prepared for it. But it was also genius in the same way. So it was tough love for me.
Yeah. Not Mr. Miyagi.
No, not at all. Not at all. But it was professional to be with someone who was running a major American theater and Black and queer and directing at that time the landmark play of the century, Angels in America.
Yeah.
So that was amazing.
Robert, that really tracks, just having worked with you as an actor now, that George, that you learned it from George C. Wolfe. That tracks to me. Because I feel like, in a way, you are a little bit of a blend of Miyagi and this energy that you're describing, in that you give us so much space, but there is tough love, you know, which, you know, is really exciting as an actor.
Well, I think it's also because, in many ways, all directors sort of know that these people are going to do whatever the hell they want to do when you leave. Like, you know,
we're not supposed to tell the actors that.
They don't give a damn what you say right now. And all of them nodding in front of you, they're going to go out there and take as I've been saying to my cast, put in as many bits as they want, take pauses where a pause ain't ever been. You know, sometimes you just have to go, you know, I'm going to be watching you and I know what you're about to do. So that's a little bit of Miyagi and also tough love, because, you know, you have no control. After the curtain opens, they are going to do whatever the hell they want to do.
Did you ever come back to a preview of Slave Play where they didn't know you were there, and the next day you were you had to send over a textbook of notes and
yes,
that was called Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. That was every day. You just had bits, bits upon bits on top.
Listen, I don't know anything about any bits.
One of my favorite memories being in the theater is after several performances post opening, being back the night the director's back for the first time and just watching his face being horrified throughout act one and then staying far away from him during intermission. I've had that experience.
Now, I remember getting a note saying one of the actors turned to the audience and said, "Stop knitting." In the middle of the play. Now, the second act is an hour-long scene with nothing but talking. And one of the actors broke character, turned to the audience, and said, "Stop knitting." And I won't say which actor it is, but that's the type of stuff I was. But one of the actors got on stage and was chewing bubble gum, got up, went to the front of the stage, took a tissue, and put the bubble gum in it, and sat down. And I'm just like, what is going on this stage?
Wait, that happened in Slave Play?
Yes, both of them happened in Slave Play. Both of them.
Oh. Well, I remember the one. The other, I do not.
Yes.
Well, Atu is not our culprit. That's what we're doing here.
No.
But I think that because, you know, when we did that scene, it was really a sort of like orchestrated, right? And that everyone was trying things. And what I would say to them is like, there's eight of you on the stage. If we pull focus, the audience is not going to look at what we're supposed to be looking at. So everyone had to be aware when it was their moment and when it wasn't their moment. And so there was a relaxation that happened. So the audience feels like, oh, this is just happening naturally. But every part of it is orchestrated. And I remember the moment in rehearsal, I think, Atu, when you were about to do your monologue and you went to the door, didn't go to the door. I don't know how do you remember that experience of going to the door and coming back and saying what I, that line that you come back with? You know what I'm talking about?
Yeah. I'm done. It's like, it's when I've expelled all of this aggression, I'm done.
Right.
And then I come back. I don't remember what that was.
I think I said, why don't you just leave and go to the door and then come back?
Yes.
And is that turning around from the door that I think everyone, especially everyone that was Black in the audience, recognize of that, I'm done with this. Oh, wait a second. I'm not done with this.
I have more to say. I have got more to say. Robert, and it was like, it was such a genius note because it was like a launching pad, you know? It was really like I could really say I'm done and mean I'm done.
Exactly. You can complete that phrase. Yes.
And really like from my insides know that I have more, I need to say more, you know? There was a real need in that note, and it was genius.
Yeah. It's like, you know, when your mother or your father goes, you know, go to your room, I don't want to speak to you. And then they show up right at your room as you're there. It's like, and by the way, or when they say, you know, are you listening to me? Are you answer me? And you answer like, don't speak back to me. Shut up.
Yeah.
That sort of moment.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So
that's
recognizable. Amazing. Yeah.
Do you think about what it would be like to do the show this coming fall or winter, whenever theater is back? Has that crossed your mind? Like what it would have been like if this was now your time rather than fall of 2019?
I think about that a lot. I mean, by the time we were done with Slave Play, you know, there was an exhaustion that had sort of set in because the play is physically rigorous, but more so it's mentally and emotionally rigorous. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the thing I kept saying to folks was, you know, I don't get to stop being Black and queer and experiencing these things when I leave this theater. It's not something I can take off in any way. And so the play just sat with me. Mm-hmm. 8 times a week, but also just in my life. So by the end of it, I was a little like, I need some space from this play. Mm-hmm. But when I tell you what has happened in the world, I feel galvanized. I feel it's necessary. I feel that I would tomorrow use any, that I would wring myself dry to do this play, because I feel like what's being talked about is so, that this conversation is deeply necessary. It was when we did it, and it's even more so now.
And you know, the interesting thing is that we were scheduled to do a production of it, do the Broadway production of it in LA. At this time, actually. Mm. And so that was canceled. And so now they're gearing up to try and do it again next season in LA. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my feeling is that, you know, it is difficult, right, to go, because I'm, as Atu says, we can't take off the trauma of it. Yeah. And so is even thinking about doing it at this point is thrilling, and at the same time is terrifying, which is also, I think, where theater is the best, where, right. You know, mm-hmm. where there's an excitement and there's a fear as well in the execution. So we'll see.
Absolutely. Well, I look forward to it being mounted in Los Angeles and having audiences post, I don't know what we call this, post-COVID, post-racial reckoning, post-Trump. Trauma, exactly.
Yeah.
Post-trauma. That's the best way to describe it.
Trumpa.
Amen.
Trumpa.
Trumpa. It's a new term. Coin it. Trademark.
Coined here on this podcast with these guests. Trumpa. Oh, I love it. Atu, what was your first professional show?
In college, I did theme park shows at Hershey Park in the summers, but my like proper like first theater job was in 2007. They did the 40-year anniversary concert of Hair, which then turned into a Delacorte run, which then turned to a Broadway show. And so like that was a little bit of a dream for me, to have my first like real, like I got my equity card doing a Broadway show. Mm. So like there, you know, a lot of my friends at the time were, you know, they were doing the EMC points. They were running around here doing regional gigs, doing this, doing that. But, you know, I had the good fortune to begin a relationship with the public theater very early on. And that was my first gig was Hair, the revival of Hair.
And were you just having lots of pinch me moments to be on Broadway and with that piece?
Too many. I mean, and we still have a group text thread that we text each other on. That was a family of people. You know, I think Heidi Griffiths and Jordan Thaler at the time and Diane Paulus, they really brought together a group of people who felt like family.
Yeah.
And I got a little spoiled thinking that, you know, that's what doing a show on Broadway was like. Everyone just loves each other, and it's kind of a dream. It kind of like seamlessly works. But no, that was a singular and special experience, and I'm so glad that was my introduction into the professional field.
It's dream time, everybody. This is where, and Robert, you can choose to direct this dream show, you can choose to star in it, you can choose to rewrite it, whatever piece of your multi-hyphenate talent you want to interpret this question with, by all means. If you could be in any show, anywhere, at any time, what would it be?
I when I was thinking about this, I was like, at any time? I think it's a future show. It's something in the future.
Yeah.
I don't know exactly what it is. I just keep coming up with these two ideas, that it is Black as fuck, it is queer as fuck, and it is like, it has all of the resources it needs. Because to me, that would signify that we've moved into a space, like Robert was saying earlier, where it's a commercial venture, but it is supported. Mm-hmm. Like it needs to be supported, you know? Mm-hmm. So I don't know what it is, but I know that it's Black and it's queer and it's a huge commercial venture.
Do you want to cast it or give me a theme or? Is it a musical? Is there dancing?
I think there is movement. I think there's music, but I have this idea that it's more experimental than we're used to seeing on Broadway. You know, I think we go further in this direction of breaking form and being in space and going into the theatrical and imaginative spaces that we haven't gone before.
Amazing.
I'm lucky enough to be able to imagine and sometimes get the opportunity to do my dream projects now. So it's always exciting to get that first instinct. And one of those were doing classics, which was is exciting to me to be able to investigate classics. I would love to do, I have these two ideas, which of course will never happen because they can't happen. Actually, just three. First idea is an all Black chorus line. I would just love to see what a bunch of Black people would do with a chorus line, you know, where everyone is Black Puerto Ricans, Black Italians, Black, like, it doesn't matter what the word is for, just Black folks. Because when I see some of these Black people on these Broadway stages, it is otherworldly what the chorus is doing. I mean, I think about the choruses of, you know, Tina, the choruses of the Temptation musicals, all of those wonderful things that is happening that was shut down. I just think, you know, it's amazing. There's also, I would love to see a bunch of middle-aged people do Annie. whereas a bunch of adults playing orphans.
And Annie too, right? Annie's also
Annie is a whole 45-year-old.
Last talking lady. About
the sun will come out tomorrow. You know,
honey,
and just living it, you know. So that's a fun thing for me. And then I also would love to do an all male version of Dreamgirls. And you know, if you put the right people in the dreams, I think it was just, you know, but those are sort of like, you know, places they're not old enough, the shows, for public domain for you to sort of do that sort of thing, but. That's a dream.
My nickname right outside of, right after college, my friends started calling me Laurel. So this is my bid right now. This is my bid right now, Robert.
I was going to ask you who's cast in this all-male Dreamgirls, because I believe in Reimagined Revivals, friends. So, play it on me.
Alex Newell would probably do, you know.
Honey. And just, so good.
Pull out the chairs and let him eat the whole stage.
Yeah.
You know, let them eat the whole stage. I love the idea of, you know, Billy Porter as, what is it, James Thunder? you know, so there's, I mean, there's all these different people who are just, you know, singing fools, you know. And that play is such tomfoolery all over the place, you know.
Absolutely.
And I would just love to see what an all Black and queer, you know, all those people that I've named were queer production would be, you know.
Yeah. Oh my God. It's genius. It's absolutely genius. Well, you know, dreams do come true. You have now spoken it. You have secreted it to the My First Show universe.
Those
and
don't let me touch Dream Girls or Chorus Line or Annie. They are not letting Robert at 50.
You got still a lot of life left, you know.
You know, Robert, I will. I see myself sitting in the, like, I will be in the audience for one of these. I don't know which it will be, but or on the stage for the Dreamgirls, like I said.
Trustees of estates change over time. Who knows?
You know, there was a Motown version of Guys and Dolls, which is very exciting. And I'm terribly interested in that because, you know, that I have the soundtrack and I was just like, I was blown away by it. Dreams do come true sometimes.
We've talked about that production here on the show with Wayne Brady.
And, oh, really?
He's a big fan of that musical and that Motown production. Yeah. So this is a perfect segue, actually, to our surprise element of the show, which you haven't been told about, and that is our lightning round, where I name a classic American musical that we all know and love, and you name the theme, the emotional theme that you think is within that musical. All right, here we go. Hello, Dolly.
Staircase, walking down the staircase and eating all the furniture in front of you.
It's like Hinge before there was Hinge.
I love it. Sweeney Todd.
Angela Lansbury and those pies. Pies for days.
Murder.
Emotional themes, guys. Emotional themes.
Oh, okay.
Angela Lansbury is not an emotional theme.
She actually is. I don't know if pies are, but Angela definitely is.
It's a full theme and a pie. Okay, go ahead. Okay.
A chorus line.
Struggle.
Making it.
The Wiz.
Home.
Blackness.
Pippin.
Existentialism.
Circus.
South Pacific.
Hate.
Yeah.
Isolation.
La Cage aux Folles.
Authenticity.
I am what I am, who I am, being who you are.
That's beautiful. That's it, guys. You did great. This was a journey of a lightning round, and we ended up beautifully.
Yeah, I don't think we got into the third question, but you know, ease our way into lightning.
I think it was murder that really needed to give us the redirect.
All I saw was actors on the stage, and I didn't see.
But that's what you're drawn to, right? To you, that's the emotional theme. It's what those people mean to you or meant to you. Yeah. That makes sense to me. That it's a totally valid answer. I just wanted to, bring you over to to center. Oh God, this was a wonderful and really fun way to talk about your play and to get to know both of you. I was thinking a lot about, and I was revisiting the New York Times review, which, as you recall, was incredibly glowing. And I remember this line at the end that really struck me as I read it in 2021, just a couple weeks ago. If slave play can bring them to a bigger audience, even an audience that is shocked or offended, it will be a happy surprise indeed. Shock and offense may be just the ticket now. And that was what Jesse Green wrote in September, October 2019. And I just think about how true that statement is about the future of American theater, even more so. And
but not only the American theater, the American politic. I've been shocked and offended for the last 4 years. Shocked and offended.
And
every day.
Amen. I think that shock and offense is something I feel like, especially in 2020, just I carried on the day to day. You know?
Yeah. And your play was doing that for years beforehand. So congrats to you, to Jeremy, to your producers, to the rest of your cast and your team for making this gorgeous, incredible, unforgettable piece of work.
Thank you.
Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
You're the best man I ever knew. There's no way I could have a girl.
My First Show is produced by Josh Altman, MEP, Dori Berenstein, and Alan Seals, and is part of the Broadway Podcast Network. This episode was edited by Derek Gunther. Special thanks to Leslie Papa and Whitney Holden Gore at Vivacity Media Group. For more info about the podcast, visit bpn.fm/myfirstshow. Follow me on Instagram @EvaRPrice. And you're gonna love me.
over. Thank you.
The Outsiders, S.E. Hinton's generation-defining novel, is now a powerful and moving Broadway hit that the New York Post is calling the best new musical of the season so far. Don't miss your chance to join Ponyboy and the Greasers and experience the classic story come to life in a whole new way. The New York Times calls it refreshing, gritty, and endlessly effective. So get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com, and of course, stay gold. They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com.